Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 277th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's Awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is the young British artist behind two of the most acclaimed and quietly revolutionary shows currently on TV. She is the creator, writer, and star of Fleabag, a BBC Three show that airs in the U.S. on Amazon, and the second season of which drops on May 17th. And she is also the developer for TV and season one writer of BBC America's Killing Eve, the second season of which has been rolling out since April. Described by the New York Times as, quote, a writer and star of strange and beguiling comedic works, close quote, The Guardian has said, quote, not since Ricky Gervais created The Office has a newcomer appeared and rewritten the grammar of television overnight, close quote. I'm talking, of course, about Phoebe Waller-Bridge. Over the course of our conversation at the New York Edition Hotel in the Flatiron District of New York, the 33-year-old and I discussed why her acting ambitions, which led her to the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, eventually gave way to writing after she met and became best friends with one Vicky Jones, how Fleabag evolved from a one-woman stage show into a full-fledged TV series, and how, independent of that, her association with Killing Eve came about, what feminism means to her and what she does and doesn't aim to communicate about it through her shows, what she has made of her brushes with giant film franchises, from her acting work in 2018's Solo, A Star Wars Story, to her recently announced gig as a writer on the next James Bond movie, plus much more. So without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Baby, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We always begin with just a few basics. Where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born and raised in London, and my mum works for the Ironmongers Guild, and my dad has a company called Amersham.
And if we were to talk to folks who knew you growing up, would we be told that you were one of the popular kids or nerdier kids, or how would they describe you?
Well, I was a committed tomboy, so I was in that whatever category that is. And I was a kind of an in-between person. I was kind of friends with kind of everyone, I think. I don't know if they'd say that. I'd hope they'd say that. I was an in-betweeny tomboy. Yeah, I called myself Alex and I was mainly up a tree.
You called why Alex?
Because actually I met a boy when I was dressed as a boy and he was called Alex and he thought I was a boy until my sister said that I was called Phoebe. And then he was like, oh my God, I've been talking to a girl this entire time. And I was like, no, Alex. And then he never spoke to me again. And so in memory of him, I named myself Alex.
Very interesting. And maybe a reverberation of your Fleabag pilot. I think there's the drunk girl that thinks you're a boy. But anyway, so your writing, which will come through chronologically, but it does seem to maybe a recurring theme, if it's a theme, is catching people off guard, a little bit of shock effect. Were you going for that sort of thing even as a kid? Were you somebody who would get a little kick out of taking people aback?
I think so, yes. I think so. Just causing a little ruffle. Ruffle a little feather.
Yeah, I read something like you, I mean, was your family sort of sharing in your sense of humor and just willingness to make a joke of things, or all of them maybe?
Oh yeah. April Fool's Day is a big day in my family. Yeah. Everyone's frightened to leave the house. Yeah, we've got quite a family of pranksters really. I remember one of my favorite ones we ever did was unroll, like, do you have chocolate Swiss rolls? Do you know what I mean by chocolate Swiss rolls?
No.
Anyway, so you can like unroll this chocolate thing,
yeah,
and it's got like a nice creamy thing inside, and us kids unrolled it and put loads of mustard in it and then rolled it back up. And then when Dad came back from work, we were like, Dad, we made you a little cake. And he was like, oh, thanks. And we were like, sit down and eat it in front of us all. We were cruel, really, but it was very funny.
I think one of the things I read prepping for this was your grandmother may have been a fun target.
Oh, yes. Yes. She was a very proper Christian lady.
Yes.
She was kind of one of those people who seemed very buttoned up, but actually had a huge dirty laugh when you made her laugh, and that was worth it.
Nice. Well, just again, anticipating some topics that may come up down the road here, sex, sexuality, you know, some families, it's you don't go into those topics. Other families are extremely open about it. Where did you guys fall on the spectrum of discussing these things?
Yeah, we were pretty open about it, I think. Or certainly, we were open about everything. I know that we were definitely brought up in a family where if you wanted to talk about something, anything, you were encouraged to. So it wasn't like we just sat around talking about sex all day, but it was definitely a sense of if I ever had any questions about sex, I could certainly go and ask my mum about it without question.
And then as you got older and it became a thing that might actually be more part of life, was that still discussed as frankly as it is on some of the shows?
Yes, I mean, maybe not right to the extent that, I mean, unfortunately they had to hear about it anyway because of the play. But I think I've always found something quite liberating about being able to talk about the unsayable things, not just for shock factor, but just because of the relief of it, you know, people actually telling you what happens behind the curtains and sharing that.
Yes. Well, so how did acting first enter the picture, and in what ways was it a part of your life before A-levels?
I always wanted to be an actress. Well, certainly an actor when I was Alex. I would sign up to anything. There was like our local church put on pantomimes and all that kind of thing. And I would really, and actually me and my friend Maria, who's also a tomboy, we used to just dress up as boys and just act on the street like we were, we'd like fix bikes for people and stuff. Like it was all total, we'd just turn over our own bikes. And there's always a little performance thing sort of going on.
Yeah.
And then so all the way through school, I was really interested in it. And then when I went to college and did GCSE drama and stuff, you know, it's suddenly finally the place where I could really hone in on it. And I realized that this is what I wanted to do for real.
Just to come back for a second, how long was Alex in the picture?
Alex was around till I was about 10 or 11.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, so getting into...
I mean, he's still here. He's just in a little dress and a jacket sitting opposite you.
So Radha, that's no small thing to get in there. And so I guess I'd like to ask you how you would describe your feelings about acting and also your outlook for your future prospects with acting going into RADA versus coming out in 06. Basically, did things change during those years to affect the way you felt about yourself as a potential professional actor going out?
Yes, very much so. There was a huge change. I went in as a 17, 18-year-old feeling like I just wanted to be a character actress and I just wanted to go and do mad things and I just wanted to kind of bounce off the walls for a few years and then also have a kind of social life and have that uni experience. And I went in, it's very regimented and it takes itself, rightly so, very seriously in terms of the hours that they pack a lot into 3 years. So that was a bit of a culture shock. Mm. I thought we'd be at the pub more than we were. That's what I'd heard from friends who'd gone to university. So it was great for discipline, but I felt when I was there doing training that there was a right way and a wrong way to act, and I couldn't work out what that meant for a long time. And it was only years after I'd left that I've rediscovered that again. That might have been a really important part of that journey for me, but I felt like there was a proper way to stand and a proper way to speak. And actually, that's not true. And I'm not sure if that's what they were trying to teach me, but that's kind of really how I felt then. And I sort of became less and less creative there. And by the time I left, I thought if I just spoke like this and had a very straight back, then I would be at the RSC in 6 months. And of course, that's not how it works.
Well, it sounds, though, from stuff I've read that they, in some ways, and I don't know who they is, but I guess maybe certain people there or certain classes or whatever, beat down your confidence a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, they do. They do. And I mean, I love me a bit of praise. praise out and a bit of encouragement. Right. And also, I don't mind messing it up as long as I know what I'm messing up. And I think that was the thing. Like, there was a sort of method, Stanislavskian kind of way of approaching acting at that drama school at the time, which again really worked for the majority of people, but it just didn't quite connect with me. And I just feel like I always want to be in the moment.
Yeah.
I want it to feel real, and I want to say it like a real person would say it. And anything outside of that would be a mystery to me. I think my job is to convince you that I'm doing this for real.
Right.
As far as my job goes.
Right.
And so these kind of sort of bizarre sort of exercises we had to do, I can never quite get my head around them. But looking back now, I do have a different perspective on it, and I can see the merit in some of them. But really, I feel like the best way to train an actor is to get them acting from the first day and just do that, and maybe get them directing, get them writing, just get them feeling what it's like to be in a play or on screen as much as you can.
Have any of your RADA classmates gone on to a lot of work yet?
Yeah, loads of them did.
People, Americans might know.
Let me see, who's in my year? So Arthur Darvill was a big hitter. He went into Doctor Who pretty soon afterwards, and he's been working here for quite a while. Cato Flynn had worked with Mike Lee, and Sean Clifford was in my year, who plays Claire in Fleabag. And I'm sure there were those others. I'll get back to you about them.
So you graduate, you come out, you're now having to look for work independently for the first time. How did that go?
Oh, it's cold out there, isn't it? It was so cold out there. But it was, in some ways, you know, you can look back so romantically at those times because it was so hard at the time because you feel so passionately. I felt so passionately about that this is the right thing for me and I really wanted to do it. But also, you know how many thousands there are and it's very hard to practice acting. You just can't just go into your room and just practice acting. I mean, maybe, and I'm not saying I haven't tried, but you want to be out there. You want to be doing it. You want to be learning. And so it was really, really hard on one level, but I knew it was going to be, so my determination wasn't knocked because of that. the best thing that happened was meeting my friend Vicky Jones. Yes. And then we started a theatre company together.
Before we go too far down that, though, this was what, like about 2 years of just a lot of auditions, but nothing clicking, or not even auditions?
Not even auditions, no. Yeah. It was just temping and doing funny accents for my family.
And did I see at one point you applied to law school?
I did, yeah, I did.
You were ready to give it up.
Well, weirdly, it's kind of hard to explain this. It wasn't that I was going to give it up. I just felt like it's not coming for me right now. And I felt like my brain was suffering. And it always really appealed to me, the idea of the law. And
it's a form of theatricality in the courtroom. Yeah,
yeah. That, and also just argument and the power of words and the power of perspective. Mm-hmm. It always really appealed to me. And it just feels like a constantly moving game and world, this, and that you have to be so present and so on top of culture and the way that people speak, you know, to keep ahead of it and on top of it. So I really, really love that aspect of it. So I thought I was going to go and do that. And then, of course, the moment I got a place at law school, I got my first acting job. So,
well, so what were some of the ones that did not work out during that period where you did get an audition, but it didn't go somewhere? Is this where Downton Abbey happened?
That's where Downton Abbey happened, yes.
What went on there? Who were you going up for?
I was going up for, oh my God, I'm so embarrassed, I can't remember the name of the character. She was the blonde sister.
Yeah.
And I went in, I prepared the role, and I went in, I was very excited. My agent was very excited I had a part for this. And I went in and played it really straight and really... I thought it was quite a moving performance, actually, in the room. I felt I moved myself slightly, yeah. I think. And then the director was laughing all the way through it, but like genuinely, yeah. He was just having a little chuckle. And I was like, that's strange. Maybe there's some sort of activity happening behind me. And then afterwards, he was like, oh, I didn't realize that this character was humorous or like funny in any way. And I was like, Jesus, neither did I. What have I been doing? So that was that one burned, but I was so pleased because the actress is so astonishing who played that part anyway. And that's so nice. You know, when you see those parts, you go, oh, I see now.
How they imagined it.
I see. And not only how they imagined it, but how it's meant to be done. Okay. You know, and I feel that so many times with auditions that you don't get. It's worse when you feel like, no, I could have, but that's so rare. You know, when you feel like I could have done that better.
All right, so Vicky Jones, let's break it really down. How did you guys first even cross paths?
So we crossed paths because Vicky was directing my boyfriend at the time. We just left drama school and he was in my year. And she was directing him upstairs in a pub for like a pub theatre thing. And she was the first real life director I'd ever been close to.
Right.
Poor thing. She obviously became this target for me. And so the show ended and she was downstairs in the bar and I went up and I was so sort of embarrassed that I was even an actor and asking her for advice or a job or whatever. You know, it's so mortifying, this whole thing. So I just went up and said, hi, I'm Phoebe. You know, I really love what you did. And if you know, I'm an actress and I really loved
it. She's basically
a
contemporary, right?
Yeah. Oh, she was older, yeah. But essentially, yeah. But I still felt like she was this like grown up in the industry, right. Even though, I mean, I soon found out that we were just as much kicking, like just, she was the same as me really.
Right.
And I asked her, and I was expecting her to go, yep, thanks. Yep. You can email this fake email address and send me your like CV, which is just a blank page. And she just went, oh my God, you're an actress. That's so exciting. Congratulations. This is such a wonderful thing. And I was like, are you taking the piss out of me? And she was like, no. She was like, that's such an exciting thing. And how brave of you to do that. And she was just so lovely. And then she did. And then I asked her for a job and she said, if anything ever comes up, I will call you. And she did 6 months later, called me. And she was brought onto this project that was a total vanity project by somebody. And the play was kind of turning into a disaster. And she cast me in it. And then she got fired. Vicky got fired.
You're still there.
She is, honestly, Vicky's like the most kind, gentle, loving, talented, generous person in the world. So for her, anyone to have any reason to fire her, I mean, there was something really dark going on. Right. So she was fired. And the moment she was fired, I quit.
Uh-huh.
And then we went to the pub together and the rest is history.
Yes. Well, it seems like she had obviously her own frustrations with the business at the time. You certainly had yours. How did you arrive at the conclusion that you should both focus on writing?
Oh, well, we started Dry Write and we didn't realize it was going to turn into this, but we just thought, why don't we put on a night of anonymous writing? Vicky had worked at the Royal Court, so she knew a load of writers and like the really exciting up and coming writers who are now like the big established ones. It's been amazing to watch them all just explode like that. And we found a pub in East London and we just asked people to write a monologue with a certain brief. I asked my actor mates and she asked her writer mates, and then it came together and we started this night, and then people wanted another one. So we'd spend the next 2 years giving writers briefs that then there'd be like 11 writers writing and we'd work on their things. I never really acted in it because I didn't want it to be like, it was just my own vantage point. Right. Didn't really act in it, but Vicky would direct them and we were producing them. And they were always questions like, how do you make an audience fall in love with a character in under 5 minutes? How do you make a guilty person appear innocent? And all these kind of challenges we gave writers. And so without really realizing it, we were giving ourselves a training ground over those 2 years, collaborating with all these writers. And then there was one time when somebody dropped out or there wasn't a writer for this one particular night which we called the mob. Mm-hmm. And the brief was to get the audience to heckle without them knowing that's what they were meant to do. And we tried to help the writers by splitting the audience into men and women in a traverse stage. They were looking at each other. So that was the kind of thing that would just sort of spice it up. And then all the pieces were quite aggressively misogynistic. Because I think the writers thought, and you can see why, that that would make women stand up out of their chairs and heckle.
Right.
And when we were reading them, we were going, oh no, it actually kind of makes us want to hide. And, and so I told Vicky, I was like, I kind of wish there was a piece in there just to balance it out that was a bit like this. And then I told her this piece and she was like, you've got to write that. And so I wrote it and performed in it and it
went
down well.
Had you written much before that?
No.
Not at all?
No, not at all. Like some like crap poems when I was like 10. But, like nothing, and this wasn't that far off. But it went down really well and I suddenly had that feeling of like, oh my God, I think I might be able to do this. And then Vicky really encouraged me. And then I wrote a couple of other short plays. And then there was one night we were at the Soho Theatre and Vicky and I were outside and she saw the artistic director standing by the door having a cigarette and she just bowled up to him and she was like, I mean, we'd had a few glasses of wine and she was like, Phoebe's got 10 short plays and they're so fucking good and you've got to put them on upstairs. And she came back up to me and she was like, you've got a night at the Soho and I'm going to direct them all. And so, I mean, I literally owe her everything because that night went on and then some producers came to see that night and then they commissioned Crashing off the back of it. And
so were they all about 10 minutes or it was just varying lengths?
They were all about 10 minutes because Vicky also worked for the Oxford School of Drama, which is a drama school, and they had a really smart idea, which is they got new writers to write two-handers for their actors because it's really hard to find two-handers for your showcase and everything. So they just commissioned young writers to do it, and Vicky had asked me to do them. So I had a collection of those, and they were all about 10 minutes long, yeah.
And was one of them the initial seed of Fleabag?
No, actually, that was another shorts night that, having done that shorts night, another friend of mine, Deborah, honestly, the power of friendship, I tell
That's
you.
That's great, yeah.
She was running her own storytelling night and she said, will you come and do a kind of stand-up-y storytelling thing? And I did that and then that's what turned into
Fleabag. So your mandate that led to that was that it be basically a one-person stand-up doing your own material.
Yeah, it can be whatever. I said, I don't want to do stand-up. And she said, they are comedians, but they're not, I mean, they're sitting down. So it's not like, it's not like officially a stand-up thing. And so she said, it can be about anything you want. And actually, I felt like because it wasn't the theatre crowd that I knew, it was a comedy crowd. Mm-hmm. I felt like I had less to lose going in there and bombing. And I went in and I just told the story of just basically the first 10 minutes of the play. But then years later, well, not years later, but like a year later after I'd written Fleabag and everything, I suddenly put the spotlight back on Jones and was like, hold on, now you write something. And then she wrote this play over about 3 or 4 days and just sort of looked at me and was like, oh, I've written this. And I read it and was like, holy shit.
Really good.
She's just brilliant. Just like searingly brilliant. I wasn't surprised, but it was just how quickly she turned it around. And then that play won the Verity Bargate Award and she was off and now
on her way too, yeah. Well, so I want to zero in on Fleabag the play, which obviously a much smaller proportion of the population has gotten to enjoy than the show that came as a result of it. So I know there are differences, obviously. So 65 minutes always, or that was what got done at Edinburgh?
No, that is the length, although it did push to a 70 once or twice in New York. And then I was put in trouble for that.
Right. So to what extent is, speaking only about the play right now, is Fleabag autobiographical?
It's funny, that question, because it's really personal, the play, but it's not really autobiographical. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone in my life that is dead in the TV show and the play is very much alive. The story was definitely a constructed story around feelings that I had that were really personal. Like, I was feeling really cynical about sex and the perception of women and feeling like I had a brain, but that my body was the most important thing, and that how that would manifest in a character, and then just amplify that loads and loads and loads. And there were a lot of the jokes are jokes that either came from my life or that I just thought about or experienced in real life, and there are a couple of like interactions that may slightly mirror things that happened in my life. but overall, it's more the emotion of it that was personal.
Well, a few follow-ups on that. Where does the name Fleabag come from?
Fleabag's my childhood nickname.
How did that happen? Where do they come by Fleabag?
I don't know.
Flea.
I guess it's Fee and then Flea.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've asked. I've asked many times. I think it just sort of came out of nowhere.
What is the real world model for the best friend relationship at the center of the show?
That's Vicky. Yeah, that's.
And was that character, though, also deceased in the play?
Oh, yeah.
So it was always driven by the idea of there's this underlying grief.
Yes. One of the first things I wrote, actually physically wrote down on a page, because I'd written loads of jokes and stuff and put them on post-its on the wall. But one of the first things I wrote, and I was just kind of free writing, and was the passage at the beginning about how Boo had died and that she was trying to punish her boyfriend for sleeping with somebody. She just thought she was going to get tangled in a bike, but she ended up getting hit by a car. And I wrote that and was like, "Boo, what
<That's dark.
laughs> that is where it's come from." But then I suddenly, when I realized that I've always wanted to write about friendship and I've wanted to write a kind of ode to my friendship with Vicky, and that was a big part of my life. So I think I wanted to express that. But actually I found it much more powerful to express that through the loss of someone like that rather than...
What did she make of, like, so this is what you would feel like, and this is what you would be like if I got whacked?
Yeah, so like, please don't, because I'm going to be in trouble.
A recurring theme in your content, I know content's a weird word, but because I'm trying to incorporate plays and shows and everything, seems to be, maybe I'm overanalyzing this, but breast size. Villanelle is described as flat-chested. You talk about breasts again in the pilot of Fleabag and onwards. And then I read a quote in another interview, quote, "I don't think I would have ever written Fleabag if I had bigger tits," close quote.
My God, did I say that?
So tell me, why would breast size affect writing Fleabag?
I can't remember saying that. I don't know. I think... So with Villanelle, it was because we needed a description of a girl who... We needed a description of somebody by a drunk person or a high person that with one little clue that said it was a woman.
Right.
And it was really hard to come up with something like that. And this high girl says she was a flat-chested psycho or something. And that was the only thing we could... So I got to cram in my boob one there. I don't know. I think talking about... They're so important to women. I know they're important to...
some men.
To straight men. Yes. And maybe some gay men. I don't know. The stakes are so high around them at school. People are obsessed with them. People pretend that theirs aren't really theirs. They're obsessed with everybody else's. And I think that it's talked about and thought about a lot more in real life than I see it talked about on screen.
Yeah.
So it just feels like something that women
talk
about.
It was a void. There was an opening in the marketplace.
I feel like we see a lot of them on TV.
Yes.
I don't know if we actually hear women talking about them.
So in 2013, I don't know how this specifically came about, but Fleabag winds up, meaning you wind up at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, and I wonder if you can describe how it went over there.
Oh, it was amazing. We were a group of like five of us, and had absolutely no idea how it was going to land, and with no expectations really, but we went on at the Underbelly, and we had a couple of kind of okay reviews, but the word of mouth thing is the most powerful thing about Edinburgh, and that's why it's such a great leveler for work, because you're up there with people, very experienced people and first timers. It's just what people say on the street. It's just so powerful that.
And are there multiple performances of it there? So if somebody didn't make, you know, the first, they can go to another one, or is it you just got to see it once?
Oh, no, we did it for 4 weeks.
4 weeks at Okay.
And so the word of mouth kind of picked up, and then we got a 5-star review in The Scotsman, and that means an awful lot in Edinburgh. And I remember us getting that and opening the paper and just looking at each other and going, oh, my God, this is amazing. And then when it sold out, we just felt... There was a lot of work that year about, like, by women, about similar kind of things. It really felt like there was something happening then, and that all of us there had kind of tapped into something that was part of the bigger conversation.
And you guys ended up winning Fringe First Award. And I guess at one of these performances, somebody from BBC was there? Is that how that all started? TV component?
Yes. Yeah. Chris Sussman, who originally commissioned the show from the BBC, he was there in the audience, and he really loved it, and then said there were so many bits of it that he could see very clearly. And then, yeah, he commissioned a pilot.
So it was a pilot. And then, I mean, you had at that point never had anything to do with TV, right? It was after that that now there was buzz around Fleabag that they're suddenly interested in Crashing and other things, right?
Yeah, so I'd written the pilot for Crashing years before. Okay. So I'd had that experience with a TV producing company, and they'd helped me develop the crashing pilot, which had then gone to the bottom of a pile at Channel 4. And then it was only when Fleabag hit in Edinburgh when they pulled it back out then. So it was strange that I ended up writing Crashing years after. And I felt like I'd changed as a writer between Crashing and Fleabag. But then so going back to Crashing and writing that first, I made Fleabag like kind of, it was kind of weird. It was a really weird kind of like model of how it was made. But they were really two different times of my life summed up in those two shows.
And now that there's this interest in having you suddenly for the first time work in TV, where it's not, it's mutual interest in you working for TV.
Yeah.
How did your day-to-day life change? Like, did you have to quickly get discipline about writing in a different way? Or, I mean, I guess initially it's the pilot, so it's, you can, it's not a massive, I mean, I'm sure it's still quite a lot, but it's, I guess the big change would be when something gets ordered to series, right?
Yeah.
And how quickly did that all happen?
Well, it took me a year to adapt the pilot. I just couldn't get my head around it. I just couldn't work out how to get that same feeling. And I kept feeling like I was betraying my little play by not being, I was convincing myself that that was the right way to tell the story, was that play. And so I was very resistant. But then the moment we got the pilot greenlit, it's that same feeling. It's a mixture of just absolute euphoria and total fear, because you have to fill that time. But then also the fun starts, because then it's just post-its on the wall. If I can have post-its on a wall, I am happy.
that's your way of mapping.
And I'm really not very disciplined in terms of time. I have no, like, it comes, I write in very like weird times of day, and suddenly I write for 3 days and then not for 4 days. But yeah, the post-its keep me calm.
Well, I guess another thing that happened in this period, I believe before even Crashing or Fleabag were on the air anywhere, was that suddenly there's a renewed interest in you as an actress for others as well, right?
Yeah.
So this is where Broadchurch comes in?
Yeah, well, Broadchurch, actually, doing the play, that gang saw me in the play as well at Edinburgh. So it wasn't even the TV show that did that. So I had done, so Broadchurch came off the back of doing the play as well.
This is the second series that went on in 2015 in the UK. And is that where you first met, I think, where would you have first crossed paths with Olivia Colman, who plays your godmother in Fleabag?
Yeah. We actually first met on The Iron Lady.
Oh, right. Can you remind? So this is 2011. That movie came out with Meryl.
Yeah, with Meryl playing Margaret Thatcher.
That must have felt like a big deal. I didn't mean to gloss over that. So that was in the otherwise drier period?
Yes, that was. And that was a massive, massive, massive deal. That makes my dry period not sound like a dry period. But it was huge. And I had one scene and it was with Meryl, and I met Collie we didn't have any scenes together, but I met her in the makeup truck and we were sat next door to each other and we just started talking and making each other laugh. And then we were sort of like, ooh, friend. So we kept in touch, and then we ended up doing a play together in the West End, and that was called Hay Fever. And this is when things were starting to sort of pick up a little bit.
Yep.
And then we spent 3 months on stage together.
So you guys,
more importantly, backstage
together. Now that you mention Iron Lady, I did see somewhere that you had a somewhat strange interaction with Meryl. What was that about?
I know. I just panicked. I thought I'd made a joke earlier that had made her laugh, so I thought that meant we were lifelong friends and that she was mine and no one else could have her. And she came down at lunch and just asked me what I was eating, and I was just so panicked in a need to have some banter with her. For some reason, I just screamed my apple crumble and threw my pudding to my chest all over my costume. Oh, she was like, oh, I wasn't gonna take it from you, but okay, thank you. And then we didn't really speak again, but she's such a wonderful person, lovely actress. She's a lovely actress.
You got a lot of promise.
Yeah. No, she's a lovely person. Obviously, she's like the one.
Yes.
She's the one I always wanted to work with. So I wish I'm not going to take apple crumble ever again.
I wonder if she's pieced
Meryl
together that person is the same one that is now probably crossed her path again. Anyway, so later in 2015 is when Crashing Now goes on the air for the first time, a show following six people in their 20s, I guess, all living together in what was once a hospital. To have that go on first, what was that like, and what was the reception like?
It was really exciting. We had an amazing cast. It was an ensemble piece, and it was a slightly different experience because I didn't have as much control as I then later did with Fleabag. Because what Two Brothers Pictures did, who were producing Fleabag. They're two writers, Jack and Harry Williams. So they gave me executive producer off the bat, which never happens. And they were like, you're right, you know what you're doing. We're going to leave you alone. You come to us when you need us. And that was very, very unusual. And Crashing, I had amazing producers, but it was slightly more traditional in that I was the writer and they were serving my Verticom's vision. But there was a lot of other kind of notes involved. And so you feel like you're trying to please a lot of different types of people. And so that experience was a bit more committed.
Yeah.
And I think I could kind of feel that. Not that it wasn't a good experience, but it was very different from going into the kind of authored thing. And it came out to a kind of, there were some diehard Crashing fans, but there was a sort of middling response in the press for it. And I was so proud of it. And I was so proud and grateful for all the actors who were in it because they were so fucking good. And it really hurt actually when it first came out because mm-hmm. you're sort of like, oh man, people don't know how much work goes in and how much love goes in and how much hope goes right. in. And then they're kind of just trashed by people. But then, you know, that's just the business. But it's really changed how, I mean, the more work you do, the more sympathetic you are to other people's work. Like, right. I will never trash another
how
person's TV show ever again. Ever again.
And we should note that you not only wrote that, but you were acting in it. How did you feel about the experience of holding both jobs at the same time? Because obviously that was going to apply with Fleabag, but I mean, when we get to Killing Eve, you probably could have done that if you'd wanted to, but declined to do so. So was that because of some conclusion you'd made on maybe along the way, possibly in the course of doing Crashing?
No, actually, it's all really instinctive. I knew I was going to play. So the whole of Crashing came from one of the short plays that I'd written that was on at the Soho that Vicky drunkenly got me a slot in. I'm making it sound like Vicky drinks a lot. She doesn't actually. She really doesn't. That was just that one. Like we had a good time in our 20s. But so that was the short play. That was my favorite. Came from my favorite short play there, and that was the one that was picked up and then expanded. So actually, all my stuff, well, both those shows came mm-hmm. from 10-minute things to begin mm-hmm. with, and I enjoyed playing Lulu. But I was also, strangely, the least interested in her as a character because I love actors so much. So I loved writing for all these other actors. And towards the end of the writing period, I mean, me and my producer, Josh Cole, were sort of like, you know, the most underwritten character here is Lulu. That's crazy. It's the one that I'm actually meant to be right. acting in. And so it did a kind of quick rewrite and just trying to make that character more complex. And I think weirdly that she's a sort of prototype Fleabag in a way, that character now, because all the complexity I think I was sort of saving or had written for Fleabag.
Which you were simultaneously expanding for TV
yeah.
at the same time you're dealing with crap. How do you do multiple projects like that at the same time and not lose your mind?
Oh no, you do lose your mind. You just lose your mind. That's right. just what you have to do.
You just have to embrace
but
it.
But it was really hard to like saying like this is going to be my TV debut character, so I want Lulu to be great, but also I don't want to make her too like Fleabag because then what's going to happen next? I mean, mm-hmm. it's a great. I mean, Diamond Shoes, very tight kind mm-hmm. of mm-hmm. problem to have. Very practically, I would just whenever I thought something funny, it would either go in a Lulu box or a Fleabag box, and the tone of the shows was slightly different. So. And then really relying on the judgment of the people I was working with, that great right. producer and George Kane, who's a great director, and they were kind of helped measure, like finding that character with me.
So Crashing is, I guess, basically dealt with while you're now still dealing with expanding Fleabag. And with the expansion of Fleabag, I wondered who you imagined the audience for this show would be and what you were aiming to convey to them. Was it the exact same thing in your mind that the play would have been for who would gravitate towards it and what you were wanting to say? Or does that change when you now have to take what I think was 3 days in the play and blow that out over several weeks and on and on?
I don't really think of a demographic when I'm writing. I'm aware of it, but not when I'm actually writing it. It doesn't affect or inform my writing. But I felt like I'd have been surprised if it was, you know, like 65-year-old men that went absolutely batshit crazy right. for Fleabag and 25-year-old women right. sort of could take it or leave it. That would have been a surprise. But the joyful thing is that it's been a kind of mix of everybody, particularly the second season. But the first one, you know, I felt like I was writing it for people who, the similar kind of people who were drawn to the play.
Yeah.
I hope would be drawn to the TV show.
When was the first screen acting? Was it something around like The Iron Lady? Because I think we shouldn't gloss over the fact that that is a very different skill set than theater acting, which is what I assume you trained in exclusively at RADA. So, like, how did you suddenly become equipped to handle acting for a camera?
Oh, it is a really different thing. I do find it a really different thing. Less and less so. But at the time, I felt like being in front of a camera, all I was taught was that you have to be very, very still and you have to convey everything with your eyes, but don't move your eyes. And it has to be a physical performance, but don't move. And if you pick that up, you have to pick it up the same way in every single time. So I was sort of like just this potato for ages on screen. I was just like, I can't move, otherwise I won't be a good potato. But then as I felt much freer on stage, I remember an actor called Stanley Townsend, I was doing a play with him at the Royal Court, and he said, and I was saying this conversation with him, I was like, well, I get, the moment I walk on stage, I get this buzz, I get this sense of power and fun, and you know, you've got the power of storytelling in you, sort of like, oh, come on, we're going to tell you a story, and the audience is there going, tell us a story. And I don't, because there's an absence of that with the screen, and he just said, you just need to give that camera the same weight as you give the audience and to see them as your audience. And it took me a little while, but that actually really helped in the end, that when you walk on a set and you feel the camera, that sense of responsibility to tell a story should come alive in you again. And it didn't. It would just die and I'd be so frightened. And actually doing the Iron Lady, I was really frightened.
But also I would think there's something about control, because what you do on stage, nobody can change, but it's out of your hand. What takes are used or whatever. Your performance on screen can be constructed by somebody else, right?
Yeah, and you don't really understand what that process is. Like, only through writing these other shows and being part of the post-production and everything, I'm seeing like, oh, that's why they do that. That's why they get that coverage. That's what a wide shot's for. Mm-hmm. That's what, you know, and now, like, I understand that so much more. It's given me way more confidence on a set. But I think because I'm quite a self-aware person, if I'm on a set, I know that there are loads of actors who completely shut everything off. And I wish I could do that. When they're on set, they're just real and they're just, it's the job of the camera and it's the job of the director to catch whatever you're doing. But you've just got to be really live. Whereas I'm always sort of just kind of want to hide from the camera until now. I worked out how it all worked. And now I get it more.
Well, so with Fleabag, where you're now, again, acting for a camera, but, much more screen time than you would have ever had in The Iron Lady, or even Crashing, where it's split with so many other people, did you feel confident then to go in on top of that, add some kind of bold things like breaking the fourth wall? I just wonder how some of those decisions were made and how confident you felt doing it with the first season.
I felt confident with like a few aspects of it, because when I feel there's something creatively exciting, I'll latch onto it. And I'm like, I know that's right. There's lots of things I have no idea if they're right or not, but that is right. And I knew that the fourth wall breaking was that the show would not exist without it, because the whole relationship is with the audience. Mm-hmm. For me, the central relationship is with the audience. And I just knew certain things for sure. Like, I knew the control thing's really interesting, because I always thought that Fleabag had control over, at the beginning, the way I thought about it was that she had control over the making of the TV show as well. So in the beginning of the narrative, so she can cut people off halfway through a sentence.
Right, and, or sex.
or sex. And she'll just, but like the actual like cut, like the actual edit.
Yes.
That she can kind of control that. She's like, that person's not interesting anymore, we can move on. And that control over the storytelling, she loses that control through the series. And then the camera lingers longer than it's meant to in a certain scene. She's sort of like, get out. I love that idea to play with, and I was sure about that. And also little things, like even before I knew what the real difference between handheld and on sticks was, or the effect of it was, I knew certain scenes I just wanted to be on sticks. I wanted to be very, very still. And usually it was the ones when she was being out of control, because it made her more exposed. Mm-hmm. Whereas often I think if they want to show somebody drunk, then they'll have it.
Wobbly, kind
of, yeah. And so it was interesting to learn all those things. And some of them are very instinctual.
Instincts, though, I guess, would still be shaped by probably things that you yourself have consumed. So what I read, Louis might have been one of the things. What are some of the things that you had consumed that most influenced Fleabag?
I can never quite like pin it to things, because I think it's always just a mix of everything you've ever watched, isn't it? But I think Louis really blew my mind open in terms of how loose he was with the structure and how kind of fuck you he was about how to tell a story, how to tell a joke. And I felt like so many of the episodes were jokes in themselves. Like, he structured the whole thing so that sometimes it would just be at the end, there'd be this moment. And they always had such depth and pathos to them. So that show really impacted me. And then I watched Alfie a few times when I was making it, because, well, for the obvious reasons.
This is like just in case anybody's listening, 1966 or something, Michael Caine and Why can you share why that would have been a reference point?
Well, he was a kind of, he's a chauffeur and he's a playboy and he's this like cheeky little chappy and he talks to the camera and he tells us what's going on in his life. And he's very misogynistic and he treats women very badly and he's very sort of dismissive about them, even to us. And the tragedy is that his life is actually not that fantastic, mm-hmm. but his bravado is the thing that keeps him talking to you. And it, that was really similar. I hadn't chimed into it until I'd realized I was a dad and I was watching all the thing, all the fourth wall breaking yeah. kind of things. And that one really affected me. There's a bit right at the end of the film when he almost gives a bit of himself up and he doesn't. And that was the moment mm-hmm. that excited me so much mm-hmm. as an audience member. And so that really inspired it.
What was it like now? You get through your first show that's in, I guess, entirely your baby, because as you're saying, Crashing was more of a committee thing. So you get it done, having now felt a little burned before with the way Crashing was received. Did you have to kind of brace yourself for when this was now going to go out to the world for the first time, Fleabag?
I did, but I had a different feeling about it because I'd learned so much from doing Crashing, but also because, I mean, the stakes did feel really high, but I really believed in the story of Fleabag and the depth of it. And I felt like it was a story. I wasn't sure. I mean, I was shit scared that people weren't going to like it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're all going to feel like that. But I felt like at the end of the day, but I felt like in a little way, this story kind of mattered because it goes places that I was proud of. Mm-hmm. So I could kind of stand a bit stronger by it then. But then, yeah, when it actually goes out, I mean, Twitter is the scariest place in the world.
Real also, time.
Yeah, real time. And I was away when it went out. I always try and just leave the country when things go out. So I left the country and then I was just, I just went on. Episode 2 was going out because I kind of knew that episode 1 was okay because it had what got us the commission with Amazon and other mm-hmm. people had shown interest. And on episode 2, I was like, this is where I die. And then I was watching our Twitter go out and then I was sort of like, oh, okay, people are laughing. People
pretty
are
quickly
liking.
Got
then,
a following, yeah.
Yeah.
I've read that one of the things that has graded on you, and I get why. It seems like anytime, whether it's you or Lena Dunham or a few other young women who have made shows that in some way touch upon issues that could fall under the umbrella of feminism, whatever, that suddenly you are now expected to become a spokesperson for that subject matter and analyst about it and all of that. So how quickly did that start to happen and how did you feel about that? Because it doesn't, I mean, I guess maybe the first place to begin is just as you understand it, what is feminism? Are you a feminist? And then getting hit with that.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly am a feminist and always have been, always will be until the day when that word doesn't need to exist anymore. I can't imagine that's going to be in my lifetime, but my best expression of how I feel about it and my own analysis of it was always in the show.
Yeah.
Because Fleabag's confused. She doesn't want to get it wrong. Like, I don't want to get it wrong. You know, I care so much about how that aspect of Fleabag landed because it was that there are, again, it's a similar thing to like the drama school thing, but like there are rules that I don't know. I can't see what the rules are, but apparently you can fuck this up. And it's terrifying because it's something you care so much about. And you don't want to say the wrong thing or do the wrong thing. And a lot of the time I think I had these secret thoughts about like having shame about my body or things that felt like if I actually expressed wouldn't be helping the cause in some way, when actually I think it's the absolute opposite. I think the mm-hmm. more that we talk about it and the more that men are interested in it as well, because women talk to each other about it all the time. Mm-hmm. So we're shouting into our own and each other's vaginas about it the whole time. And you just want, and it's when it's now it's great because men are listening and are interested and in a public way as well. And I think I've gone a bit off track from what your original question was. But
well, I guess what we could do now is talk about how, because this only, in terms of the feminist conversation, was only that you've been, you know, become more and more people want you to be a part of. That was only exacerbated by Killing Eve, which comes in because, I guess, initially of the imagination of Sally Woodward Gentle. Can you tell people who she is and why she would have ever thought that she should approach you about doing this?
Well, Sally runs Sid Gentle Films and she read Fleabag when it first was in London after Edinburgh. And she'd read it and she'd got these novellas that she'd read from Luke Jennings and she was crazy about them, rightfully so, and then sent them to me and said, would you consider this? And they were considering a bunch of other writers and she said, you know, what do you think about this? And I was like, oh, I mean, yes, I couldn't believe that I hadn't even made a TV show or anything at that point. And she had said, you know, you've written this monologue. Come on, like, what do you think about this drama?
Right.
And there was something about someone just having that faith in you from the off just immediately makes you up your game. And I was like, yeah, I'd love to do that. And then I had to wait for like Crashing and Fleabag to be done. And then jumped on board and had a falafel with Luke Jennings after Fleabag when he came to see it. And we just talked about psychopaths and obsession and, you know, all those kind of things. That's a great thing about being in this industry is I met Luke after 2 minutes of talking of meeting Luke. We were talking about kind of psychopaths and like sexual obsessions, right, over a falafel.
But it seems like it would be a totally different endeavor to have to now adapt someone else's pre-existing work as opposed to writing just what comes out of you and your experiences. So I read that at one point you did turn it down. So why did you turn it down, and then why did you reconsider?
Oh, Killing Eve.
Yes.
I turned it down because of time, and only for that reason, because I had Fleabag to make and these things move fast and I just assumed they'd want to move on. And then Sally said, no, we're going to wait. And she came back and so it was Crashing and Fleabag around that time. And I was like, oh, mm-hmm. God, now I'm doing Fleabag. And then she just waited and waited and waited. And then when it came round to it, we then had to do this huge document together. It was like a 15-page document that we were taking out. And then it got knocked back by a bunch of people. And the process is so long.
Yeah.
But I love the idea of adapting it because so much is already there. And it's a relief not for it always to be something that you birth completely yourself. Yeah. Like, conceive and birth. Yeah. Yeah.
How seriously was it considered that you might play one of the two women?
It came up like early, but I felt just again very instinctively that these weren't for me. Like they didn't really, I don't think the characters wanted me to play either of them. But I'd also written, they're actually closer in age in the books. They're both in their late 20s. Mm-hmm. And I just had a really strong instinct, which Luke was totally behind, that there should be this age gap. Because again, it was something that I just felt like I hadn't seen. And I'm not a 25-year-old Jodie Comer. I mean, let's be frank. And I don't know if I could have scaled a wall quite like she could have done either. And, you know, and I'm not in my early 40s either. So I wrote myself out of it. And then I kept saying, kind of accidentally, just, you know, honoring the work. Mm-hmm. But then I was like, oh, I'm going to write myself a part so that I can be murdered by Jodie. And unfortunately, we just never got around
not
to
yet,
it.
Not yet.
I know.
Just a random question, but was Eve, I'm not familiar, you know, I didn't read the books. Was Eve of Asian descent in the book?
No, she's not in the books, no.
So for you, this is just sort of may the best actress win.
And for Luke, absolutely, for everybody. Yeah, totally.
Because it's been a major, you know, thing, obviously, for Sandro's made some history with all of this. And I just thought it was, curious how that came about. But what were the biggest changes, aside from the age, aside from the ethnicity, any other major changes that where you deviated from the book?
Carolyn Martins, that character, played by Fiona Shaw, that character was based on a male character in the book who pops up less than she does in the TV show. And for various reasons, you need people to be around more and you just kind of up characters' presence and stuff. But I really felt like to have this triptych of women, one, you know, 25-year-old, 41-year-old, and then I don't know how old Fiona is.
Yeah.
But just those three generations, I just thought it'd be really, really cool. And Luke was just thrilled. He was so behind it. And then various story things. We only had up to book 5 before, so we had to write beyond. But Luke was with us the whole way.
I got a kick out of, like, you know, a few things where you've talked about the appeal of Killing Eve for you, where it's like, yes, when you actually stop and think about it, there, how many shows can we name where both the pursuer and the pursued are women, where the way that somebody taunts somebody else is sending them the clothes that fit them better than anything else, all of this. You have also said that, quote, the challenge was to make it feel very violent without actually showing anything, close quote. And there really isn't much gore and violence or whatever. But at the same time, you were saying for women, it's particularly resonant to have it this dynamic because so often, and maybe men don't even realize it, there's constant violence against women, but is there sort of cathartic to be able to turn the tables with that? And you think for you and for the female viewer?
I think so, definitely. Yeah, definitely for me. I think having that, just having all the women not have to be victims was just already refreshing. And that's when I first read the novellas. I couldn't believe it. It was like, you know, sometimes it just takes a real genius to come up with a simple idea. And Luke writing that these two, it was a female cat and mouse. It was just like, God damn it. Like, why has no one thought about that before? And also that they are that they're trained and that they get, they just get, just, and also just for actresses to get to do the same things that actors do. Like my thing the whole time, because probably I am an actor as well, is I want to write things that actors love playing, because I think audiences can feel that in an instant, and right. it makes it even more electric. Yeah. And being able to say to Jodie, you know, you can, this is your character, this right. wild, unpredictable girl, and you don't even have to take your top off.
Right. I want to just talk about how, what you decided to do, I guess because of just the massive workload of juggling these multiple shows here, you did not return as the head writer for the second season of Killing Eve, but obviously we're still very involved. But the interesting thing was you handed it to another female writer who I think is a friend of yours. And it seems like that is the game plan. The show's not ending anytime soon. That is going to be something that you want to continue to do in the same way that you want to keep the writers' rooms and the crews particularly diverse. Is that a decision you have made for moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, but with Sid Gentle as well, you know, it's very, everyone felt very passionate about yeah. it, and the actors as well. You know, it's hard to catch a break in this industry,
yeah.
and you know, historically, really hard for women to be trusted. I think often with women in the industry, you can fail once, and then you're gone. Yeah. With guys, I feel like you have a few more chances, and so people are given less of a chance. And so the idea is just to be able to give a season to a woman who may not have written TV before, but you just know they've got it. They've got it,
yeah.
And because that's what they did for me, and it
right.
paid off. And I think it's paid off, you know, and it will continue to, because they're brilliant, brilliant people across
yeah.
the board.
Fleabag season 2 is about to hit the world. And I just wonder, from reading some of your more recent interviews and profiles and whatever, it seems like you had some reservations about doing a second season. So what were they? How'd you get past them? What are you proudest about this second season?
I was convinced that Fleabag would only be one season because it was an adaptation of the play, and
right.
the play had an ending,
yeah.
and then the TV show had an ending. And what was really great is that there wasn't any pressure from the channels, like there always is, really, to keep something open. And I felt like I wanted this ending and for season 1, and it was going to end. And so they were all like, yeah, that's fine. And then they were like, just think about maybe having a second one, just because it went, you know, it went down quite well. So
yeah.
then I did, and I was just worried that I wouldn't, that I'd tell the same story again. My biggest fear was that the most interesting version of that woman's story had been told mm-hmm. in series 1, and that she had to move on and she had to grow. And actually that time in between the 2 seasons was really important, because she could come back and she was believably a different person,
yeah.
had grown up a bit and needed different things from the world.
And we see her, like, what's like the least likely thing she would be after the first season, I guess, religious.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I was so interested in that,
yeah.
in that being a theme for it, and what religion means to us now, and those basic Christian principles, how they apply today, and that she would come up against that already
right.
seemed funny.
We had some news break today. There was definitely, each time you've done the role of Fleabag, there has been sort of, all right, that is it. It's not going to, I've done all I can with it. I'm moving on with my life. Today, we learned that has been extended one final time. Can you just share, for people who haven't gotten the memo yet, what will be happening in August?
Yeah, we're coming back to the West End. So we're going to be playing at the Wyndham's Theatre. And it just felt like the perfect way to end the whole journey, because we went, our theatre company, you know, Dry Right, from Edinburgh to the West End, just felt like just a great way to send her off.
Right. And finally, I wonder just about how these things that started as 10-minute plays that, you know, you probably never thought would be performed outside of a intimate theater setting, how they have sort of led to not only full-fledged shows, but also to just kind of massive things that you might not have ever imagined. We can reference, you know, you were a droid in Solo, A Star Wars Story, which was funny because when I saw that announced, we had Jerry Seinfeld on this podcast in 2016, and we're asking, you know, would you like to do more acting for other people? And he's like, I would like to play a droid in Star Wars. I would like to be called, Are You Serious? So, and he would just be a droid that goes around asking, Are You Serious? What do you really need to do the flipping and the kicking before, you know, moving your lightsaber and all that? Does it really add anything? Are you serious?
I'm glad you're pitching that again.
Yeah,
let's put that out there. Let's put that out in the world.
So that was one. But now, the latest, I believe you will be joining another franchise, and I guess at the request of James Bond himself. So how did that come about, and how do you quite process where this has all led?
I think I'm still processing it. I think it might be one of those things that I don't process until like way after. Like right. When I finished Star Wars, it was about a week after I'd finished it, and I was just on a bus, and I suddenly went, "Oh my god, I was in Star Wars!" And I called my sister, and I was like, "Yeah, I was in Star Wars." She was like, "Yes, darling. Yeah, you finished a week ago." I think you just sort of know the grindstone so quickly. Right. It's the kind of thing. And I think, yeah, I got the call from Daniel and Barbara Broccoli, and they'd been obviously talking about it, and just thought it would. I don't know, it would work. And so came to meet them, and it's really exciting. The film they've got is really, it's such an exciting story. And, so, and you know, it's just, it's just been a joy to work on.
And you'll bring some of the female, feminist sort of humor that we've enjoyed in other stuff, maybe that has not always been present in that franchise. Yeah.
Well, I mean, we'll see. We'll see what I can sneak in.
Right.
But it was mainly just making them feel like real
right
people,
right,
you know, which they do in the previous films. I think Daniel's films have done, you know, we've had really, really fantastic Bond girls. So it's just keeping up that.
Absolutely.
Keeping it up there.
Thank you for doing this. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thanks very much for tuning into Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/TheRace. Finally, be sure to check out the other podcasts that are part of the Hollywood Reporter's podcast network, all of which are excellent. Leslie Goldberg and Daniel Feinberg's TV's Top 5, Seth Abramovich and Chip Pope's It Happened in Hollywood, Carolyn Giardina's Behind the Screen, and Josh Wigler's Series Regular. On behalf of all of us at The Hollywood Reporter, thanks for tuning in.